Today, Pastor Tony and Pastor Dan are, well, Tony's about to leave, but Pastor Dan is in Vietnam, and so I actually have the full run of the church all by myself. And so I feel like we should have, no, I'm just kidding. We're all pitching and we're going to the beach. But no, it's really fun to be part of a pastoral group that has so many different facets. And today, Pastor Tony gave me a topic. And when he gave me the topic, at the very beginning of it, he made a point for me to mention how awesome he is. So, here it goes. Tony, you're great. That's all I got. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's true, though. Tony is an awesome human being. And when I look at our friendship and our working relationship and what he brings to the table, I truly have to say that Tony is pretty kick butt. Because he is so nerdy and somehow can translate all of these historical documents that just look really boring and time-consuming into actual constructive sentences and stories and relevant information, which is the only reason I'm at all successful in my life is because Tony sends me notes, right? He's like, hey, Sarah, FYI, here's how you can sound smart. And so today, I'm following up on that, and I appreciate Pastor Tony and his ability to be a teacher and to be able to lead a community and to create this space, and I really appreciate what he's done here. So there you go. Shout out to Pastor Tony. Before we go any further, let's go ahead and have a quick word of prayer. Dear God, thank you so much for today. Thank you so much for everyone here, for Sabbath, for community, and just the ability to come together and worship and help the things that come out of my mouth to make sense to other human beings. We love you so much. In your name, amen. So I remember when I was in seminary, which is, I think, almost 4 years ago, which is crazy. I remember this one particular day. I'm pretty sure I had just ditched a class and had eaten a bagel in a tree, so I was a little disheveled, and I realized I was late for my next class. So here I go barreling into the seminary building, and as usual, I don't have the best of luck in who I encounter in those most frazzled moments. And so I go barreling in, and as I'm stepping up onto the step, in mid-leap, someone yells out to me, and he says, hey, I've seen you around. And I was like, and I awkwardly turn around, like, mid-step. And the guy looks at me, he's like, yeah, are you really a seminarian? And I was like, yes. What? I didn't even know what he really meant because I was like, well, I go to school here. What defines a seminarian? Is it just someone that attends or is there like a league I need to be part of? And so I'm sitting there trying to figure out what his question was. And then he says again, he's like, so you want to be a pastor? And I was like, never. Because if you remember, at that point, I actually wasn't going to be a pastor again. I was in a chaplaincy program. So I very, very confidently repeated myself saying, no, I'm not trying to be a pastor, thinking that this could diffuse any kind of situation that might come out of this, because obviously this man has something important to tell me. At that point, he steps a little bit closer, and he was like, oh, I have a question. And I was like, okay, go for it. And he's like, do you do ministry? And I was like, ministry? And he was like, yeah, I just feel like we could do ministry well together. And I was like, did you just make piano playing motions to me? And I realized that to this man, the only kind of contribution I could bring in the seminary or to his ministry was the fact that if I could play a piano. For him, the only reason I was there was to find a husband and to link up and do ministry. And it was such a bizarre moment that I just started laughing because I am so mature. And I burst out laughing and I was like, sure, but more the accordion style. And I ran up the steps. Yeah, it was awesome. Thanks, Tim. So today, Tony asked me to speak on a group of people in this movement in Acts that were being called to join into this disruptive church, this disruptive community in a new way. While in seminary, I learned that there are very different roles that are perceived to be for pastors, for women, for people in ministry. I found that much of the time I didn't realize so much that my identity was based off of my gender. I found that my ability to minister was tainted by some's view by the fact that I was just a woman. There have been countless times where I've stood in front of several people that were using words or arrows in hopes to puncture my dreams or maybe something that I care about. There are some moments in life that we're told we just can't do something, only to realize that we truly can do something. We truly are allowed to do that thing. Just because someone else says you can't doesn't mean you can't do it. And half the time, it's not even about that thing. It's about something completely different that the person doesn't even realize is an issue for them. And it is truly how we handle that conversation that ends up mattering. In many of my classes, I found that my mere presence in that classroom as a non-married female studying theology was as distracting and disruptive as if a very live group of bears came into the room banging pots and pans and doing hula dances on the desk. People would sit there in shock, almost in horror, upset, weirdly fascinated, just kind of hoping it doesn't happen again. This is what was happening in Acts. Women were coming on the scene as more than the bearer of children and carriers of water. And there are many places in Acts where there are female leaders, pastors, and they are described very clearly. Acts describes this disruption and chaos of the Jewish culture that always had been. Today we're talking about how disruptive women were. Thanks, Tony. I almost have to get over myself to speak on this topic because for years, the battle over women in ministry has stolen so many of my conversations at dinner or around cool events. And so often my dreams get kicked around just a little bit because they say that maybe it's not something I should be doing. For years, I've accidentally been the topic of conversation about how rebellious I am. And my rebellion is becoming a pastor. I'm just not sure that I'm the true adventurer that they think that I am. In California, this topic isn't as big of a deal because lots of you have never actually had to go to the East Coast to hear that people are still very much so caught up in that conversation. Some of you may not know that my mother a couple years ago in Indonesia wasn't even allowed to stand on the stage near the podium. She had to have a music stand on the bottom because she was a girl. My mother works for the General Conference. My mother has dedicated her entire life to the church, and I'm not even sure that she was preaching that day. I'm pretty sure she was just there to do a presentation. There have been many times where I've gone to different countries and I've had to stand on the shore and watch the people I've been working with for 3 weeks get baptized, and I can't even be that close to them because I was the wrong gender. There are times when I've gone to the Dominican Republic where my family lives, and I went to visit my grandpa or my step-grandma, and I can't actually tell their friend what I do for a living because I don't want to ruin their friendship or their relationship, and God knows I cannot mention that I got ordained. And so many conversations are cut short, or maybe people are set up for a slight failure in the conversation if I choose to go that way. And it's all because I was born the wrong gender to have a voice. Now, I don't typically like to stand in front of people and actually have this conversation because I feel like a lot of the time, this conversation becomes very self-serving for me. Because if I stand up here and I prove why women should have a voice, I'm really the one that gets the voice. But what about all the other people around me that don't have a voice? Many people read Acts or Timothy and see the silencing of women. Yet when you actually spend time reading them, you begin to realize that maybe surface reading isn't really what's going on here. You have to remember that when you're reading ancient literature, things are a little bit different. There's the person writing it in that time period to a group of people in that time period, and then there's you reading it in your time period. There are three different readers going on constantly as you read the Bible, as you read the ancient text. And if you look at it that way, you must be able to assess the fact that surface reading may not be the exact way to go about it. It's enjoyable, yes, but it's kind of dangerous to start quoting those kinds of things at people without knowing the context. And so you must look at the culture and the context and the realities that the people were living in that it was written for. And perhaps the things that we throw them off are not things that would throw us off. You see, a few weeks ago, I was at a presentation where they were talking about historical literature. One of the presenters was presenting this concept, and they used the analogy of 1 Timothy 2:11. Now, 1 Timothy 2:11 is by far one of my favorite verses that people use to remind me of my status. What she said here, let's go ahead and read it. A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. Beautiful, right? All right, your support is awesome. Okay, yeah, so a woman should learn in quietness and full submission. Now, this was used, I once walked to my door at home in Michigan, and my door was covered with lovely verses like this. And it said, I should learn in quietness and full submission. And I thought, well, that's interesting. But you see, when you read this, let's pretend nowadays there's a teacher that gets up in front of their their college course, and they stand there and they say to the entire college course, now, women, this entire semester, you are not allowed to ask questions or talk. You can only sit there and learn. Do you think that would go over well? Okay, maybe you do. I don't know. All right. But yeah, no, that would not fly now because that is so far from where we live right now. Now women are allowed to be in the classroom. They're allowed to raise their hand. They're allowed to ask questions. So when people read this now, they're like, oh, man, that's pretty brutal. But you know what's interesting about this is if you're reading this in that culture, what do you think stands out to them? What do you think the part that blows their mind away is? Learn. A woman should learn. What? This is mind-blowing. This is something beyond the norm. This is something that is revolutionary to them. This is something that they've never experienced or seen, especially in the Jewish culture. This is an impossible feat. Women should learn. They're allowed to learn. The quietness and full submission is a respect thing. But the fact that they can learn is what's blowing people's minds. Acts starts out talking about the election of church officers. And so if you are in Acts, you can read Acts 1, 15 to 25. And as you read through that, there's actually no mention of excluding women from serving or voting. That's a pretty huge deal. You see, the door has now officially been opened for people to step into something beyond themselves. And if you go further into Acts 2, 1 through 21, starting at verse 17, actually, and in the last days it shall be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. Yea, and on my men servant and my maidservant, in those days I will pour out my spirit, and they shall prophesy. And it shall be that whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. First off, verse 17, your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Women are recognized as having the gift of prophecy and the privilege of prophesying. Second part, both male and female are gifted by the Spirit for the sake of the gospel, so that those who hear and call on the name of the Lord shall be saved. You see, Jesus came into this moment, and suddenly he changed the conversation and no longer became just a men's group or just a one group of people being able to talk about it. He opened up the door for everyone to hear the good news and to talk about the good news. And that's our call. We're following Jesus. Jesus said, please tell the good news, spread the gospel. But this is crazy talk for that time. And then you go to Acts 15:22, and it says, then it seemed good to the apostles and the elders with the whole church to choose men from among them and send them to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas. They sent Judas, called Barsabbas, and Silas, leading men as part of the whole church, participated in the decision-making process of the early church. So they sent men, but the whole church was part of picking who they would send. This would include the women as well. And this is incredible because if you read this in context, women who have been sidelined are now not being told to sit there silently anymore and are implicitly encouraged to get involved. Then you go to Acts 16:13 to 14, and it says, and on the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate to the riverside, where we supposed there was a place of prayer. And we sat down and spoke to the women who had come together. One who heard us was a woman named Lydia. A significant part of Paul's ministry was to convert women. This hadn't been a goal before, because if you just converted the man, the woman would simply follow. This moment sheds light on the intentionality of educating the women around Paul. The fact that Paul addresses a group of women with none of the men present reflects his attitude, an attitude that is so much like Christ. If you look in John, you can read the story of the Samaritan woman. Jesus steps out of his comfort zone, out of the traditional Jewish culture, and reaches out to a woman that is a Gentile. Although the Jews would not let women form a synagogue or even count them in the number required for the formation of such or give them access to the systematic teaching offered therein, Paul draws on this group of women to form the nucleus of the Philippian congregation by creating house churches. It's the only place in society in those times that women had a voice. And Lydia housed a congregation in her home, which means Lydia would have been the head of that church community. If you go to Acts 17, 4, 12, and 34, it says, "And some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a great many of the devout Greeks, and not a few of the leading women." Now, this is significant. "Many of them, therefore, believed, with not a few Greek women of high standing as well as men. But some men joined him and believed, among them Dionysius the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them." You see, Luke considers the woman among the converts on a parity with the male converts. He makes no distinctions. And if you note the pairing, it says, "not a few Greek women as well as men, and among them Dionysius and Damaris." Acts 18:26 says, "He, Apollos, began to speak boldly in the synagogue, but when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him and expounded on him the way of God more accurately." You see, here Priscilla is named first. This is most unusual, and the only possible explanation is that she was more important than her husband in this community. In what sense? Well, if you look at it from secular standards, you would see that maybe she had all the wealth, or maybe she was the leader of that community. See, she outranked Aquila in the terms of social status or independent wealth. If you go to Romans 16:3, it says, "Priscilla is called a fellow worker." If you look at that in Greek, it says synergos. It's a term used also for Titus in 2 Corinthians and Timothy in Romans, both pastors and teacher. It means a fellow worker. In this sense, it would hardly have been silent, submissive, and subordinate. By using these terms, Paul raises a theological claim for himself and his helpers. Their assistance in proclaiming the good news, the gospel, means that they share with the apostle the burden of the ministry of reconciliation, of tearing down bridges and walls that separate people from everything else. The verb expounded, ektethemi, is the same verb which describes Peter's public teaching when he defends his eating with the Gentiles against the criticism by the circumcised believers. And is the verb used to describe Paul's public teaching of the kingdom of God. So some of you might be shutting down about this point because you're like, okay, so you're, you know, proof texting how women should speak out. That's not actually my goal here. I'm just pointing out that this isn't actually the revolutionary part of what is happening here. The fact that women are leaders and teachers is pretty common in the Greek culture. It's just new to the Jewish culture. The point of all this textual support is that women shared a large role in the early church leadership. The early church disrupted the common practice of the Jews' hierarchical system. This was not abnormal, like I said, for the Greeks or the Romans. Female teachers, leaders, were a very common occurrence in those times. The early church completely disrupted the status quo, though, because they followed the trajectory that Jesus had set forth by breaking down walls, by letting everyone be part of the good news. From an uptight elitism to an opportunity to be a leader, they opened their arms to women taking positions. Women teaching? That's unheard of in the Jewish faith. Women leading worship? That probably would have never happened in the Jewish faith. Women being part of a council decision? Yeah, they weren't even invited. Then you go into move into 1 Corinthians 14:34, where it says women should remain silent in the churches. They are not allowed to speak, but must be in submission, as the law says. If they want to inquire about something, they should ask their own husbands at home, for it is disgraceful for a woman to speak in church. The context was that before, women were not allowed in the same room as men during worship. However, for this early church, they decided to tear down that literal and metaphorical wall, and they allowed the women inside. There is typically, if you don't know this, a literal wall between where the men could worship and then where the women and children would be. And so very often, the women couldn't hear anything, and so they would sit in their little side quarters and just have conversations about what they're making for dinner and so on. Suddenly, you allow these women to come into the main sanctuary setting, and then you suddenly realize that maybe they're on different education levels. And so when Paul and them are talking about this, that's what's actually happening here, is here are women sitting in the pews, and the teaching and the education levels are totally different. Because the men know Aramaic, and a lot of the Torah and other things are being read to them in Aramaic. So the women are sitting there going, huh? What's happening? Because they haven't been educated in that language. And so, of course, if any of you have ever been to any other country or in a room with people that do not speak the same language as you, you know how this feels. Again, I was just 2 weeks ago in the Dominican, and I don't know if you guys know Dominican Spanish. Have you heard it? It is like on steroid speed zone. Like, it is out of control. And they'll be, like, full throttle, like rambling at me, and it's so out of control that I'm looking at them and I only speak Spanglish, and suddenly my eyes just start glazing over. I'm like 20 sentences behind. I have no idea what I'm agreeing to, and they are so excited that I can't help but nod with them. But then suddenly I'm like, Ivan, I say to my brother, what are we talking about? And he doesn't know. So then we start speculating. And we start making up our own scenario and what's actually happening in the conversation. And pretty soon, before we know it, we're in our own side conversation. And that's what's happening. These women are sitting in this audience. They don't understand what's going on. At first, they're trying to go along with it. And then suddenly, they realize, we have no clue what's happening. And so they start talking to each other. But if you know anything about spacing, sometimes you're not sitting by your best friend. So you have to be like, psst, hey, what are you doing later? Right? And soon conversations come up, and soon the disruption happens in worship service. See, what Paul is really telling this group of women is that during this time, he's asking them to be considerate of the other people around them. Learn to be the bigger person and respect the space. You see, this is a truly disruptive way of thinking, the fact that they're even allowed there on top of him just silencing them to make sure that they understand about respect. And then we go to 1 Timothy 2:8-5. This is actually where the original verse came from. And it says, therefore, I want the men everywhere to pray, lifting up holy hands without anger or disputing. I also want the women to dress modestly with decency and propriety, adorning themselves not with elaborate hairstyles or gold or pearls or expensive clothes, but with good deeds appropriate for women who profess to worship God. A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or to assume authority over a man. She must be quiet. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not the one deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner. But women will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with propriety. You see, what's interesting right here is that Paul is not actually once again condemning them for being a woman. You see, when I look at this, I kind of freaked out a little. Because I was like, oh, you're right. There are so many things in here that I'm doing totally wrong. You see, I braid my hair once in a while. And sometimes I'm not so good at being quiet. And sometimes I just have an opinion about things that I know nothing about. And I definitely haven't bore a child yet. Good job. You're following things. That's good. Bear children, right? And this is good. These are all beautiful things. And like, this is part of the challenge we have. And sometimes when we read scripture, we're like, oh, this I can buy into. This makes sense. Ooh, that's not good. I can't buy into that. You see, there are two things that I really think are important to point out here. You see, historically, the Romans had female teachers, and they were known for using their authority to punish young male pupils in the city. These female teachers would dress like the goddesses of Rome with braids and jewels, and often they would use their power to humiliate or entice their pupils into forms of worship that caused the teacher to feel a sense of power and control. So the concern Paul is addressing right here in this moment is that some of the women in this new movement that was booming had more Gentiles involved than Jews. Do you remember that verse that said, not a few devout Greek women? There were a ton of Greek and Roman women getting involved in this movement because they had encountered an experience with Jesus and they were interested in what was going on. However, they brought their background, they brought their other stuff with them, and so they started teaching the way that they had been taught and they knew, and so they started using this power over people, and they were beginning to use this power to oppress some of the men in the community. You see, authority is a poor translation of the Greek word Paul uses in 1 Timothy 2:12. The Greek word Paul used for authority in this passage is authentein. It means to abuse authority or misuse power. Paul's restriction was given in the context of a personal letter to Timothy giving advice about a specific issue that the church was facing at that point. There's no command here, and it doesn't seem like it's decreed for all eternity, but rather it is a space where he's encouraging women not to take this newfound power and lord it over other people. So here, we can finally move beyond the shock that women are leaders and religious leaders in this new movement. Here, what is most pointed and critical is that Paul is essentially telling these women that we're abusing their power to learn to practice submission in certain moments, learn to show oneness. He was essentially putting their egos in check, holding them accountable for their actions. and reminding people that being a leader often requires some silence and submission, so you can hear what people are actually trying to say to you. In faith communities, it's sometimes hard to tear down walls and sometimes easy for certain groups to begin to feel a sense of power and importance, to begin overusing the powers that they've been given and begin to hurt the people around them. As Christians, we are called to a compassionate way of life. Diffusing anger and distance can often be found in something as simple as a hug, and other times it gets a little bit more complicated and it goes into the fluid act of compassionate living. Yet once you tear down that wall between you and them, something amazing can happen. And that's what Jesus did. He tore down the walls of negativity and elitism, of oppressive behaviors, and he began to build up love and compassion and grace. And he started a movement that was full of openness and oneness. There's a story that has influenced my life greatly, and it's one by these amazing writers, authors, entertainers. I don't know if you guys remember the good old Your Story Hours. No one? Just me? All right, I'm awesome. Your Story Hour. It's a series that was built for kids, and I remember growing up on them. I had the cassettes. I had the records, like the little ones that would go on, and we'd listen to them every Friday night and Saturday morning, and I love stories. And there's this one story that came to my mind that kind of blew me away when I was writing the sermon, and it's a story of this guy and this lady. They're married, they've lived in this farm for a really long time, and suddenly the moment comes where they have to sell the farm because the property is too valuable for all the retail and all the movements of that community. So he sells it. It was a land that was inherited by his father. And he then goes, they decide to go on a vacation, and they're going to road trip to find a new farm, a new home. And so that's exactly what they do. They hop in the car, and they go on this road trip, and they're hitting all these communities, checking out all these farms. And as time goes on, they finally get to a place in Wisconsin. And they see this magical community and this magical land, and they're like, I wonder if there's a farm here that we can buy. And so that's exactly what they do, is they go and they find a realtor, and they go and start checking out the property. And there was only one property, and so they go, and it's beautiful. It's the perfect kind of land. It's everything they wanted. The house was perfect, except for things were kind of falling apart. And so they said, why is everything kind of run down? And they're like, well, no one can really stay here very long. We've had a lot of tenants in the last couple years. And they're like, oh, okay. But everything was perfect. And so they went to him and they're like, okay, so how much is it going to cost us? When the guy told them the number, they were blown away because it was way lower than they ever thought could be. And they're like, something is not right here. And so they go back. As soon as they get dropped off by the realtor, they hop in their car and they go back. And it's perfect. Everything's perfect. So they get this idea. Let's go find a neighbor and find out why no one lives here long and why it's so cheap. And so that's exactly what they do. And they go and they find the neighbor. And the neighbor begins to talk to them and tell them, like, yeah, I know exactly why it's so cheap. It's all because of that old Mr. Grimes, your next door neighbor. Yep, he's an evil, evil man. Anyone that lives there, he just destroys them. And Jim, the husband, was like, what? And Cora's like, well, what does he do? Well, he's just malicious and he's awful. And Jim's like, I know how to handle that. And so he says, if old Mr. Grimes messes with me, I'm going to kill that old devil. And of course, the woman like gets shocked and she doesn't know what to do. And the wife's like, honey, no, we're not killing anyone. And it gets weird at the moment, but they decide to buy it despite all the warnings. Everyone they ran into said the same thing. Don't buy the property. He will ruin your life. Soon they move in. A month goes by. They're rebuilding a bunch of things. And Jim goes to the hardware stores and he inherits a cute dog. So he goes home and he brings the dog and they become best friends and they're running the farm. Some more time goes on and then one day he comes outside and he goes to milk the cows and they are nowhere to be found. And so he goes and he starts hunting for them. He realizes that the fence has been cut and all the cows are out by the lake. And so he brings all the cows back in. He starts laughing. He says, all right, it has begun. And so he decides instead of just mending the fence, he decided, I'll build a gate. I'm going to build a gate. So he puts a gate in. He's like, this way, if Mr. Grimes wishes to let the cows out again, it won't be as much work for him. So he put the gate in. A couple more days go by. And then he goes in and he finds out that his wife is freaking out because there's no water in the house. She's yelling, saying like, why is there no water? Did you turn off the water? What happened? And he goes, oh, I didn't do anything. And she's like, well, figure it out. We're not eating until we get water. And so he goes out, and he, sure enough, out by the lake, he finds the pipe dug up and busted apart. So he brings her some water, and he goes down, and he mends the pipe. And he goes, instead of putting it back in the ground, I'm just going to make it an above-ground pipe. That way, if old Mr. Grimes wants to, he can just come break the pipe, and he doesn't have to do as much work. Later on that day, Cora, the wife, sees that the truck goes by their house, and as she watches, she realizes, oh my word, that's old Mr. Grimes. And she sees that the truck is full with potatoes, and she begins to say, oh, potatoes? I don't really think I saw that coming. And so she runs out, and she's like, Jim, hey, just so you know, old Mr. Grimes just went to town, I guess, to sell potatoes. And Jim gets this big smile on his face, and he's like, all right, I'm going to go check out the property. And so he sneaks over, and he looks at the house, and he looks at the garden, and he comes back, and he's a little sad, and he says, Cora, the poor man, everything is run down. He doesn't have a healthy garden. There's weeds everywhere. And Cora says, wow, maybe we should bring him some. So they go to their garden, and they fill up a basket with fruits and vegetables, and then she puts some pie in a container, and he sneaks it back over and puts it on the front porch. The next day, because all of that stuff had happened, she didn't get to laundry until late. And so she decides to hang up all the laundry, and as sun is going down, she realizes there's no way it's going to get dry in time. But she looks up and also notices that no clouds are on the horizon. So there she goes, and she leaves the laundry out, and the next morning she comes out to grab it, and sure enough, all of her laundry is all over the ground with muddy footprints, and it's destroyed. She is crushed and horrified, and her line is cut, and Jim comes out, and he's like, I'll pick it all up. She goes inside. He fixes that. She's all disgruntled and upset. And later that night, he decides to calm her down by reading her some good old scripture. And he talks about turning the other cheek and the importance of all that. And as they go through, she finally realizes, like, oh, you're trying to be nice to him despite all of the stuff he's doing. The next morning, he goes out and he finds their dog dead. And it's this traumatizing moment where he finds this puppy and he's like, what happened? He takes it to the vet and he realizes the dog has been poisoned, and Cora is livid. She's heartbroken and she doesn't know what to do. And she's like, I don't want anything to do with this old Mr. Grimes. You need to go over there and talk to him and deal with this. And he says, honey, last night you were just talking about baking him some bread. And she's like, I know, but he has killed our puppy. And at that moment, she says, but you know what? You're right. I said I was going to take on this challenge. We're going to be nice. We're going to go over all of the stuff, even though he's been so mean. And so she bakes that loaf of bread, and she goes on over, and they drop it off on his doorstep as he goes by to town that next day. The next morning, Jim is out front working on something in the garden, and he sees the truck go, and it's Mr. Grimes once more with more potatoes. And as he goes in front of their house, it gets stuck in the mud puddle that's there from the storm. And he says, I know how to handle this situation. And so he goes and he gets his tractor. Without a word, he hooks it up to the truck. He pulls him out of the mud. He unhooks the tractor and is about to get back in the tractor when old Mr. Grimes can't handle it anymore. And he bursts out of the door and he's like, stop, just stop. I don't know what you're trying to do. He's like, I've done nothing but evil to you and cruel. And then you bring me fruits and vegetables and pies and bread and you do all of this stuff to help me. He's like, I just don't understand what you're doing. And Jim begins to smile. And he says, welcome home, neighbor. This entire time, the only goal was to tear down the walls and the barriers that had been put up by anger and hurt. And he soon found out that his wife had been killed and that he'd been living in this sad state of living for so long that he just didn't want anyone to know how miserable he was. And so he'd built all these negative walls around him. And he just thought if he had to be miserable, everyone else should be miserable. And soon they became friends, and soon they began to hang out more, and the stories came out, and it was just a beautiful experience. And you see, what's so amazing about this is that we can learn to have compassion, even if it's an impossible feat. We can learn that when we are placed in positions of power, or even in the possibility of power, to bring freedom and not oppress people. We learn to be humble leaders rather than tyrants, leaders in society, in the home, in the church. Anyone that claims Jesus is a leader. And we are taught to have compassion. We are responsible for tearing down the walls that people are putting up, trying to keep people out. Church should not be a community that reflects abuse of power, but a power that heals those who have been abused. Christianity was a place of healing, and that was what the movement was all about. Christianity was a reminder that someone once lived so different and beautifully and compassionately that he gave voice to the outcasts, life to the broken, and power to the lowly.
And this is the key to what it means to be a Christ follower. We follow Christ. We become a power that heals those who have been abused by the world around them. We learn not to abuse our power, but to learn to share it and think of the other person over ourselves. When we do this, we truly experience the kingdom of God.